KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time for the fish report here on KSDP. We have a harvest summary for the Alaska Peninsula with most fish harvested on the north side, as well as chignik harvest, chignik escapement, and escapement across the peninsula, along with some Bristol Bay numbers where they hit the 1.4 million fish harvest mark for the day, so it has begun. For the Alaska Peninsula, on June 25th, 2025, 43,000 sockeye were harvested across the area. That's 629,000 to date. 1,000 chum were harvested as well. The totals for the districts, Shumen Islands had no new fish harvested yesterday, but the South Unimak had 1,000 sockeye reported for a total of 297,000. Nelson Lagoon had 10,000 sockeye harvested and delivered for a total of 58,000 to date, and Port Muller to Outer Port Hyden, 34,000. They're now at 174,000 to date. Going over to the harvest summary for chignik, 21,000 sockeye harvested in chignik yesterday, for a running total now, 58,900 to date. Most of that in Chignik Bay, 54,000 sockeye have been harvested in Chignik Bay, and the Central District had 4,500 fish harvested. Looking at the Alaska Peninsula for the Weir Report. Yesterday, 6,100 sockeye went up the Chignik River. They're at 182,000 to date. Starting to see a couple of years in the last 10 catch up a little bit, but we're still pretty far ahead of those years, starting to lag behind 2017 and 2016, though, where they had about a quarter million each in those 2 years. 21,000 sockeye up the Nelson River. They're at 114,000. The next biggest year was last year, where by now they were at 34,000. But looking at 2023, 19,000, 1,800 in 2022. Even 2017 and 2016, they were at 16,000 and 7,000, respectively. 2,600 up the Bear River for a total of 23,000 to date, and that's kind of the midpoint of where they've been the last 10. Illinik had 760 fish up the Weir for a total of 16,000. 15 up Oceanoy for a total now of 758,000, trailing only 2016, which had 966. Illyuk had 3 fish up the Weir for a total of 64 to date, and that's much more than the last 10 years. Now for Bristol Bay, they're at 1.4 million fish harvested yesterday for June the 25th. That makes them a total of 3.6 million to date, and most of that was caught in the Nushagik. The Ugashik had 116,000 for a total of 574,000, 114,000 at Egigik for a total of 482,000, 1.2 million at Nushagik, they're at 2.5 million to date there, and 2,600 over at Togiak for a total of 8,800 to date. Again, cumulative harvest so far this year in Bristol Bay, 3.6 million. And that will do it for the fish report here on KSDP. This report was brought to you by the Aleut Corporation. Stay tuned for more great programming coming up right now.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A federal court Wednesday halted the closure of Job Corps locations across the country. In May, the federal government announced it was pausing the Job Corps program, which helps people ages 16 through 24 with career training. The Associated Press reports a lawsuit is challenging the move, and the court ordered the government to keep the program running until the lawsuit is resolved. The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma raised concerns about the program's closure, saying it was the first tribe to operate a Job Corps in 1978, and the program was serving around 150 students. In Texas, the city of Dallas plans to rename 3 man-made lakes along the Trinity River in honor of tribes. KERA News reports the city council voted Wednesday to name them Three Sisters Lakes, with each lake named after a tribe that has ties to the state. American Indian and Alaska Native communities in Colorado continue to face gaps in healthcare access, quality, and outcomes. According to a new analysis of the Colorado All-Payer Claims Database, Eric Galatis has more.
While these communities face higher rates of many chronic conditions, they're also not getting important preventative care. David Wright with the Denver Indian Center says fear remains a primary barrier, pointing to decades of mistreatment, including the forced sterilization of women and federal policies that forced medicine men and other spiritual leaders into mental asylums up until 1978.
Native people for a long time have been used to advance medical research without their consent. And so there's a large mistrust within the Native communities against the medical profession.
Between 2018 and 2024, American Indian and Alaska Native people were diagnosed with kidney disease, autoimmune, nervous, metabolic, and endocrine disorders such as diabetes at rates far above their white peers. Wright says the analysis, produced in partnership with the Center for Improving Value in Healthcare, will be used to create a culturally tailored education program for health providers. Without additional training, Wright says health professionals are likely to continue to assume that chronic conditions are due to an individual's dietary choices. Many don't understand that for over 100 years, tribes had to rely on government rations, typically high in carbohydrates and salt, to get enough calories. Poverty, lack of affordable housing, and the breakdown of family systems also disproportionately impact health outcomes. Wright says better health will require treating the whole person, not just specific medical conditions. When people are out of balance in any one area, he says there are ripple effects.
If we're not able to provide stable housing, which is not only a mental and emotional and physical importance, but it also will affect the outcomes and the teachings and the role modeling you need for your children and your family structures.
This is Eric Galatis.
The Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes recently received grants from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, but as Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reports, other housing-related funding for the tribes is a little less certain.
Tribes across the country receive federal support through the annual Indian Housing Block Grant. This year, the Eastern Shoshone Tribe got about $2.3 million, and the Northern Arapaho Tribe received about $3.6 million. Amarielle LeBeau is the director of the Northern Arapaho Housing Authority.
We get this block grant based on a formula, right? And so it's based off the units and our need.
The money keeps housing authorities operating and helps maintain their current housing. Trump's proposed budget would decrease that funding by about 20%. An earlier draft also called for eliminating a competitive community development grant. Gilbert Ritchie is with the Eastern Shoshone Housing Authority and says losing that would have a direct impact on future projects.
That's the primary funding source for us to spearhead new housing development.
I'm Hannah Haberman.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian Country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com. Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
There'd probably be a pretty significant cost shift over to private insurance, and so you'd see an increase in premiums for everyone else.
Thousands of Alaskans could lose health insurance if Congress approves changes to Medicaid. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 26th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Fairbanks residents under evacuation notices consider the risks of staying put.
I could see the flames taller than the ridge, you know, probably 150, 200 feet tall. I said, it's time to maybe go somewhere.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media loves being part of your day. Thank you for listening and for your support.
Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
The Republican mega bill making its way through Congress would make significant changes to benefits programs like Medicaid and SNAP, and those would affect Alaskans across the state. The so-called Big Beautiful Bill with tax and spending cuts is changing fast, and it'll likely keep changing right up until the bill passes. But for now, as Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, here's what we know.
If you ask the chief advocate for Alaska's hospitals and nursing homes, Jared Kosin, there are plenty of ways to improve healthcare in the state. Kosin, who heads the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association, says reducing the number of people with health insurance isn't one of them.
This is terrible healthcare policy, and the predominant issue with it is it's premised on achieving a savings target. That's what they're after, to fund these tax cuts.
The Congressional Budget Office, Congress's official scorekeeper, estimates that the version of the bill that passed the House would push 16 million Americans off of government-funded or subsidized health insurance. Divide that by Alaska's population, and you get somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 or 40,000 Alaskans at risk of losing insurance, either from Medicaid or the federal health insurance marketplace. That doesn't mean those 30 or 40,000 Alaskans won't need health care, but Kosin says they won't get it until it becomes urgent. Hospital emergency rooms have to see everyone, even those who can't pay. He says that would push up the cost of health care for everybody else.
And what you can expect from that is there would probably be a pretty significant cost shift over to private insurance. And so you'd see an increase in premiums for everyone else to offset these massive losses.
Kosin says the drop in the number of insured people, especially in low-income rural areas with many Medicaid patients, would force hospitals to cut back on services or even close their doors. Here's how it works. The bill House Republicans passed includes new work requirements for Medicaid. That means every 6 months you have to prove to the state which administers the program that you have a job and that you're working at least 80 hours a month, or that you're exempt. Right now, the state is already struggling to keep up with the paperwork it's tasked with and has a well-documented backlog. Billy Stapleton Jr. is a state benefits processor and union representative who went to Washington to push back on the bill. And he says new paperwork requirements would make things worse.
That would cripple us because Medicaid's renewed once a year. Now we have to focus on one case and put eyes and hands on it twice a year.
The Alaska Division of Public Assistance is already way behind. He says he's currently, in June, processing applications for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, that have been pending since November. Speaking of SNAP, by the way, the House version of the bill has provisions that would require Alaska to pay tens of millions of dollars for the SNAP program. And whether the state could afford to pick up the tab is unclear, says State House Finance Committee co-chair Andy Josephson, an Anchorage Democrat.
Will the legislature writ large and the governor support backfilling those items? I don't know. That's an open question.
Another open question is whether the SNAP provisions make it into the final bill at all. And that's a lot of what Alaska's Senate delegation is saying right now, that the bill is in flux. The spokesperson for Republican Senator Dan Sullivan says he's working hard to ensure the final bill doesn't reduce Alaskans' access to Medicaid or SNAP benefits. She says Sullivan generally supports work requirements for Medicaid and doesn't see them as a cut, but she says Sullivan has pushed for a variety of, quote, exemptions and carve-outs to protect vulnerable Alaskans. The bill exempts most Alaska Native people, people in high unemployment areas, parents, veterans, pregnant women, and people with mental health conditions, including substance abuse issues. At the same time, though, opponents say that just applying the exemptions would be challenging for both the state and the applicants. But there's another thing to note. The Senate's working copy of the bill allows the federal government to exempt states like Alaska from implementing the work requirement through 2028. That's as long as the state makes a good faith effort to upgrade its system to handle the new requirements. But there are no guarantees the state would get that exemption. A spokesperson for Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says she continues to have concerns about the bill and its impact on Medicaid and SNAP. It's unclear when the Senate will take up amendments and start voting on the bill, but it could be in the coming days. President Donald Trump is pushing for the final bill to be passed by the 4th of July. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
Wildfires have been threatening neighborhoods on the fringes of Fairbanks since late last week. The borough has put hundreds of households on the highest level of evacuation notice, though some were just downgraded. The Alaska Desk's Shelby Herbert visited the evacuation point for the Haystack neighborhood northeast of town, where some told her they faced tough choices about going or staying.
Jim Strickland lives on Haystack Road, just a few miles from where the Himalaya and Haystack Road fires are now smoldering. Smoke drifts from the hillside, but it blends into the rain clouds above. Everywhere you go, it still smells like a barbecue. The borough just downgraded the evacuation notice for Strickland's neighborhood, but just a few days ago...
I could see the flames taller than the ridge, you know, probably 150, 200 feet tall. I said, it's time to maybe go somewhere.
Strickland fled to town. He'd been under an evacuation notice for a couple days by then, but many in the neighborhood declined to heed it. He says that's generally the way it works in Haystack. He remembers another close call a couple years ago.
It got probably a mile, mile and a half from my place that time. But, you know, I was watching it and people come, and you know, everything's a risk, but you kind of measured out.
The fire was one of two major blazes that ignited around Fairbanks late last week. Since then, the borough has issued about 5,000 residents some degree of evacuation notice, from get ready to get out. There are still a few fires scattered around the Haystack community, but recent rains have calmed things down somewhat. Strickland says he's returning home, for now, but he's ready to drop everything and leave again if the fires pick up. Some Haystack residents never left at all, like Robin Metzner, who says it looked like doomsday over the weekend.
And homesteads were pretty much surrounded. Yeah, that was kind of... It's one of those feelings where you can feel the walls closing in.
Metzner, wearing a sidearm but no shirt, is getting ready for a fire preparedness meeting in front of his house, a cathedral of antlers, Halloween decorations, and emergency provisions piled high.
I mean, my place looks like the flotilla from Waterworld.
The Haystack neighborhood includes off-gridders, farmers, and quite a few self-described rugged individualists. The borough had the neighborhood on the highest alert, the one called Go, but many households refused to leave, opting to try to defend their homes from the fire themselves. Metzner says many are reluctant to leave because they have so much to lose. It's not easy to build back from a fire so far away from town.
This is all we got. If we lose our properties here, winter's coming. You know what I mean? I don't think people are like, oh yeah, well, you know, you'll get insurance, it'll be fine, and we'll pay you. And I, you know, ideally that's how the system should work, but it's not. Unfortunately, it gets really cold in about 3 months.
Fairbanks Borough Mayor Grier Hopkins says the local government doesn't issue those evacuation alerts lightly, but he says he hopes people leave for their own safety and the safety of the whole community.
When people heed the evacuation orders, it helps keep our first responders and firefighters safe because they're out there doing hard work. And if they're able to do their jobs without distractions, everybody's lives and property is going to be that much safer.
Back in Haystack, Metzner says he and other residents are planning to hold a community safety meeting when it's all over to talk about what worked and what didn't. He says, hopefully, they'll celebrate the fact that they all pulled through. Maybe with a barbecue. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Shelby Herbert.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, St. Paul residents remember the forced relocation during World War II with a softball game.
It's important, you know, for us to make sure our kids and the future generations know, like, what happened to our people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's environment and economy and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help prevent the spread of invasive species by remembering to play, clean, go. Removing all plants, animals, and mud from boots, gear, and vehicles before entering and leaving recreational areas will help stop invasive species in their tracks. Learn more at playcleango.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Governor Mike Dunleavy told lawmakers yesterday he had vetoed a bill that would have sharply limited payday loans in Alaska. Senate Bill 39, which passed the legislature on a bipartisan vote of 38 to 22, looked to cap interest rates for so-called deferred deposit advance loans at 36%. Backers of the bill, including the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, say it's an effort to curtail what they describe as predatory loans. Claire Lupke is the group's economic justice lead.
We know that payday loan customers in Alaska are taking out over five payday loans per year, even though they're marketed as one-time emergency assistance. And we know that this causes cycles of debt in which people are taking out one loan and then another, trying to get out from what they originally borrowed.
Democratic Anchorage Senator Forrest Dunbar sponsored the bill, which passed along caucus lines in the Senate. Three minority Republicans joined the multi-party coalition controlling the House to pass the bill in the lower chamber. Opponents of the bill say it would unnecessarily limit consumers' choices and reduce loan options for borrowers with poor credit. Andrew Duke leads the Online Lenders Alliance, a financial technology group that opposed the bill.
The proponents were trying to paint a picture that if you enact this bill and put more restrictions in place, lenders will just keep making loans to the same borrowers at lower cost. That is patently false.
Governor Dunleavy declined an interview request but made a similar case in his veto message. A variety of other states have similar limits on payday lending. The federal government also restricts it for active duty military members. Lawmakers can override Dunleavy's veto with a two-thirds majority vote. That could prove difficult, though, since proponents would have to pick up at least two more Republican votes to override the veto. In Anchorage, police are looking for a man accused of slamming a pickup truck into a downtown restaurant this spring, severely injuring an employee and causing major damage. 42-year-old Robert Thomas Miller is charged with assault, criminal mischief, and leaving the scene of the crash early April 20th at Anchorage Pelmeni. Mark Moore, the restaurant's owner, says locals have offered lots of support after the crash. Staff are selling dumplings out of a tent next to the Fifth Avenue building.
From that end, it's been really amazing, man. The community's come out. We get to see people every day. The wind and the rain kind of make us go inside or just shut it down, so we kind of miss having walls.
Police say responding officers found a Dodge Ram truck partially buried under debris in the building. An employee told them he had heard screeching outside, then saw headlights approaching the windows. The impact sent glass flying into the man's left eye. Road cameras showed the truck reaching speeds near 100 miles per hour before it struck the restaurant. A dashcam video from another vehicle then showed a driver and passenger running from the truck after the crash. Police say blood found on the driver's side airbag matched Miller's DNA, which was already on file in a state criminal database. The photo on Miller's driver's license also appeared similar to images of the truck's driver seen on surveillance video outside a nearby nightclub. At Anchorage Pelmeni, Moore says about $200,000 of work to repair the storefront has been moving quickly, and the restaurant should formally reopen next week.
We might not have paint on the walls yet, but once we can operate in there, we're going to move right back inside.
Police are asking anyone who sees Miller or knows his whereabouts to call them at 311. You can find a photo of him in the online version of this story at alaskapublic.org. Military helicopters have been spotted buzzing communities across western Alaska this week. KNOM's Ben Townsend called up Alaskan Command to find out what it's up to.
In the summer, helicopters like these two U.S. Army CH-47 Chinooks aren't uncommon in western Alaska. Still, the helicopters can cause quite a stir for communities not expecting them.
Citizens were calling us saying, I think the Russians are invading us, kind of thing.
That's Kotzebue Police Chief Christopher Cook talking about exercises in the region last summer. At Tuesday's city council meeting, he said he spoke with planners for an upcoming exercise.
They're not hiding anything, they're not doing anything secret. They just want everybody to know that there's nothing, they're not preparing for anything specific. It's just the annual training that they do.
Residents in Nome and Shishmaref also reported Chinook and Black Hawk helicopters. Sergeant Donald Hudson with the Alaskan Command says the helicopters are doing site surveys, which aren't too different from planning for a summer vacation.
You're doing your research to find out, you know, where you're going to be staying, where you're going to be eating, how you're going to get, you know, all the people in your group to go there and be there for a chunk of time.
The site surveys are part of an exercise called Arctic Edge. Hudson says the exercise is designed to improve readiness and demonstrate capabilities in the Arctic. Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson and Eielson Air Force Base will host the exercise, with activities planned across the state, including in the Aleutians. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
In late May, the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities sent out a press release announcing its intent to move forward with the Cascade Point Ferry Terminal. It would be located 30 miles north of Juneau's current ferry terminal. In Skagway, officials bristled at the news and unanimously agreed to send a response protesting the current plan. KHNS reporter Melinda Munson has the details.
The Skagway Borough Assembly voted at its last meeting to send a letter to the Alaska Department of Transportation expressing their numerous concerns with the Cascade Point Ferry Terminal. Assembly members say the project could be inaccessible and uses funds that could benefit rural communities with aging infrastructure. Here's Assemblymember Deb Potter.
This is in direct response to the DOT's announcement that despite our constant input that Cascade Point Ferry Terminal would have some issues and concerns for Skagway, they're moving ahead with it anyways.
The new ferry terminal would cost approximately $77 million and is meant to supplement existing ferry services at Auk Bay. It would be built on land owned by Gold Belk Incorporated, a native corporation in Juneau. The Department of Transportation says the terminal would cut up to 2 hours off of Skagway and Haines Ferry trips and provide better reliability by reduced marine miles and exposure to weather. The state says the new terminal would also save on operating costs. The state has been considering the Cascade Point Ferry Terminal for approximately 2 decades. But the Skagway Assembly wasn't sold on the proposal. One of their concerns was the state investing money in new facilities while ignoring older infrastructure in small towns. Again, Deb Potter.
It's a little disappointing given the state of our ferry float that sank 10 years ago and still hasn't been replaced.
Assemblymember Orion Hansen brought up logistics.
It's hard to get from Auk Bay to downtown Juneau or to the airport or anywhere, and 30 miles further where there is, to my knowledge, nothing, sounds a lot worse for us.
The Assembly's letter to the Department of Transportation questions how the Cascade Point Ferry fits into the long-range plan for the Alaska Marine Highway System. The state accepted bids from contractors on the project through mid-June. In Skagway, I'm Melinda Munson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. Make your impact at the University of Alaska Anchorage. UAA is a leading workforce provider offering you a path to the career you want, with over 100 academic programs for you to choose from, an array of in-person, online, and hybrid course options, and resources to help you succeed on your journey. UAA is what you're looking for. Apply today. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
A Haines nonprofit has been working for years to build a large facility capable of churning out compost for farmers and gardeners. The facility itself is complete, but the plan is stalled amid a heated debate over a neighboring driveway that proponents say is important for the project but belongs to the local cemetery. KHNS's Avery Elfelt has more.
The issue came to a head late last week during a Haines Planning Commission meeting. On the agenda was a land easement application by the Tokchinook Watershed Council. The conservation organization wants to use a slice of land next to its new composting facility for a driveway and bear-proof fence. That slice covers about 0.09 acres. It's owned by the borough and is part of the local cemetery. The bulk of the cemetery property is across the street, and the application notes the site has been used as a driveway by neighboring landowners and, more recently, was strewn with abandoned boats, cars, and tires. The easement application cleared the Planning Commission on Thursday after hours of public comment dominated by opponents who were adamant that the Watershed Council should not be allowed to use the area.
No, we don't have any land to give away. We are trying to preserve the land we have.
That was Rock Ahrens. He and his wife, Diane, have served as volunteer managers of the cemetery property for more than 3 decades. Ahrens laid out his concerns during the meeting and on a phone call with KHNS. He says the Watershed Council should have designed the facility according to the constraints of its own property, and he says the cemetery needs all of its land and wants to build a pavilion and columbarium on the same site.
And so it's just the aged population that still lives here that the reason that we're starting to be concerned about running out of space.
In a June 11 memo, Haines Interim Borough Manager Aleka Fullerton noted that the cost of a columbarium is not currently in the budget. Some opponents said they aren't against composting, but they think the facility is too close to the cemetery and could draw bears to the area. Others, including Randa Szymanski, object to the group wanting to use cemetery land in the first place.
I'm not opposed to composting at all. I'm opposed to you taking part of the Jones Point property. That's inappropriate. You have another place that you can put your access.
The Tokchmik Watershed Council, for its part, says it's more complicated. The group owns 50 acres in the area, but much of that is used for public trails and conservation work. The compost facility itself borders a wetland and a creek on two sides, which would complicate building a new access point. Building the facility itself cost $250,000 in grant funding. Derek Poinsett, the group's director, said in an email that creating a new access point could double that sum. During the meeting, Poinsett said the group explored buying or leasing the land in 2022, but that wasn't possible due to the nature of the cemetery deed. The borough later recommended pursuing an easement.
Like I said, the site where the compost facility currently sits has been used for industrial purposes for probably 80 years, maybe more. And what we are asking for here tonight is permission to build about 150 feet of fence to enclose about 40 feet of existing driveway.
Without access to the driveway, Poinsett said the organization could downscale its planned operations. It could abandon the project, or it could expand the site and build a new access point. The group doesn't currently have funds for the last option. Five planning commissioners voted in favor of the motion, with one, Commissioner Jerry Lapp, voting against. Poinsett is a commissioner, but did not vote due to his involvement. The application will head to the full assembly next. In Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
83 years ago, soon after fighting reached the Aleutians during World War II, the U.S. military forced Ununga residents of St. Paul to leave the island. The community was in the middle of a baseball game when it happened. St. Paul now marks the anniversary of that evacuation day with a commemorative softball game. And for the second year, they held another game in Anchorage for people who used to live on the island. The Alaska Desk's Theo Greenlee has the story.
The batting order is going to be Pierce, Oga, Miles.
18 people take the field in Anchorage's Delaney Park on a recent Saturday. It's a sunny day, perfect weather for softball. Dmitry Zaharov used to help organize the game in St. Paul until he moved to Anchorage a few years ago.
It means a lot to us. Commemorate our people that were relocated in 1942. So it means a lot to us to be able to host this event that's sponsored by the LA community of St. Paul. It's bringing people together. So it's great. It's great fun.
June 14th, 1942 was evacuation day. Ununga people from St. Paul and other communities around the region were sent to abandoned canneries in southeast Alaska. The conditions were overcrowded and unsanitary. Many, especially children and elders, died from disease and starvation.
Okay, you guys, come on the field. Let's get started.
Kava.
That's Olga, Dmitry's wife, another one of the game's organizers.
It's just important, you know, for us to make sure, you know, our kids and the future generations know, like, what happened to our people.
Umpire Thomas Bordakovsky cracks a Coors Light.
My first beer. I'm good.
He's ready to go.
Play ball.
The military called it an evacuation for residents' safety, but only Alaskan natives were forced to go. White residents were allowed to stay. Roughly 10% of the evacuees died in the ordeal. When they were finally allowed to return, American troops had torched many homes and plundered the rest. Even the church was ransacked. But they worked hard to rebuild. Now it's becoming harder to live on island. Elders are moving to Anchorage to be closer to medical care. Younger people are leaving to find work. Zenita Melavidov is in the stands. She's one of the few remaining elders who still live in St. Paul. Today she's in Anchorage for her granddaughter's graduation.
I miss them, old people. Nobody come around anymore. It's just sad.
Still, the game's vibe is upbeat. It's the bottom of the fourth, and the score is 17-3. Grade schooler Chloe Zaharov is on second base, and she's feeling the pressure.
Stressing. I'm having fun, and I'm stressed at the same time.
Run! The batter drives a hit to right field. Zaharov takes off to third. The fielder throws to third, but it's short. Zaharov rounds the base, starts in on the home stretch.
Go home!
An infielder nabs the ball, throws it to the catcher. Zaharov leans back to slide. Safe.
Oh, I feel really good about it. Yeah, I slid. It felt magical. It felt cool. I was pretty nervous, but I'm feeling good now.
Melavidov cheers her on from the stands. Melavidov was born just after the war, but grew up in its shadow. She heard the stories firsthand and even visited the old internment camp at Funter Bay near Juneau.
Now it makes me think about my grandparents and the elders, what they went through.
One of those elders was Edna Floyd. She spent the first year of her life in Funter Bay. She died in 2018. Her son, Jeff Kaufman, lives in Wasilla now.
And she survived there as an infant for a year. It was really sad, but we also feel fortunate. Yes, and today was a good celebration of that.
Chloe Bordakovsky grew up decades after the war's end, but she still thinks about it. She says connecting with her traditions and with her community help her learn how to live with the knowledge of what happened in St. Paul.
My mentors have recommended that now in time that we get to choose our memories. So either that be good or bad, and I think our community is choosing happy ones moving forward.
The game winds down, and the final score is 29-11. Well, some might call that a blowout, but Bordakovsky, surrounded by friends and family, says it didn't feel like anyone lost. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Theo Greenlee.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Shelby Herbert in Fairbanks, Chris Clint and Theo Greenlee in Anchorage, Ben Townsend in Nome, Melinda Munson in Skagway, and Avery Elfelt in Haines. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
So long that I've waited for a girl to come into my life and in guess you're just all my dreams come true. And I'll be your lover, and I'll be your best friend. I'll be there when you're needing me. I'll be your everything. Your together at last, we shouldn't think about our problems in the past. It's true love takes a miracle to find. I guess that I've been blessed, 'cause I've got you by my side. And I'll be your lover, and I'll be your best.
best friend.
Follow through completely. So won't you give me all I have?
she had a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College. That's where I caught her eye. She told me that the tap was loaded. I said, in that case, I'll have room with Coca-Cola. She said, fine. And then in 30 seconds time, she said, I wanna live like common people. I wanna do whatever common people do. Wanna sleep with common people. I wanna sleep with common people like you. What else could I do? I said, oh, I'll see what I can do. I took her to a supermarket. I don't know why, but I had to start it somewhere. So it started there. I said, pretend you got no money. And she just laughed and said, oh, you're so funny. I said, yeah. I can't see anyone else smiling. Are you sure? You wanna live like common people. You wanna see what common people see. Wanna sleep with common people. You wanna sleep with common people like me. But she didn't understand. And she just smiled and held my hand. I went to fly to the shop. I cut your hair and get a job. I smoked some facts and played some pool. Pretend you never went to school.
Such a laugh.
Yeah. And the chip stains of grease will come out in the bath.
We will never understand how it feels to live your life with no meaning or control. And with nowhere left to go. You are amazed that they exist. And they burn so bright whilst you can only wonder why. Or rent a flat to burn. Cut your hair and get a job. I spoke so fast and play some fool. Pretend.
still alive. The boots have come and trampled on me, and I'm still alive. Because the sun has kissed me.